Coming up, I have two guests with a special announcement. Justine raves more about one of her book recommendations than I can recall in a long time. And Mia Manasala discusses Filipino food, diversity in mystery novels, and is it okay if someone calls your book a good beach read? I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. If you're hoping to hear from Justine today to give her book recommendation, don't worry. She will be coming up in just a few minutes. But first, I have a couple of guests on. I have Stephen and Jacob, and they have a special event coming up pretty quickly. It's the Pride Book Fest. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for having us.
Oh, thank you for coming. Hello, Jacob.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
Happy to have you. So let's just start right off the bat. Pride Book Fest, what is it?
So Pride Book Fest is a book festival for queer authors and queer books to celebrate anything that these authors really wanted to talk about, to highlight queer books in a way that we've never seen queer books and queer stories highlighted before. It came from Jacob and I having conversations about wanting to showcase these queer stories and highlight the things that make them unique and beautiful, and really give these authors a platform in a way that we haven't seen done before.
And what is that going to be?
We are launching the festival on Friday, June 11th, and that's going to continue into Saturday, June 12th, and Sunday, June 13th. Oh, yeah, we haven't decided on the schedule yet. We're still playing because we're still recording a couple of panels. We haven't figured that out, but that's going to be announced most likely on June 7th. I think that's a Monday. And yeah, it's going to be pretty much all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday.
And this is all on YouTube, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
The majority of everything will be on YouTube. We will have a couple like kind of pop-up events like on Instagram Live. And maybe some other platforms, but everything primarily will be through our YouTube, correct?
I'm excited, and I'm sure our readers will be excited, that you do have a panel called Be Gay, Do Crimes, which
yes. Has
writing queer thrillers and mysteries. And there
yes. Are
a few folks that are on the panel that have been guests on our show. Wendy Hurd's been on, PJ Vernon's been on.
Love them.
And coincidentally, later this episode, Mia Manansala is my guest.
Oh, fabulous. We love every single one of those authors. Mia, Nikesa, Nick, PJ, and Wendy, they are rock stars. And we recorded that panel a week ago from the time of this recording. And it was such a blast. And I think your listeners are really going to love everything that they talk about. They take, you know, a craft point of view, talking about plot building and character building and you know, the difference between like a slow burn mystery and more of like a high octane thriller. And they really just, I think, illuminate a lot of things for both readers and writers out there who might want to try their hand at writing a thriller or mystery.
And the cool thing is, I think by the time this premieres, the schedule will be out. So I think the idea was that we'll announce the 7th. I think this goes out the day after, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And so, but if you're listening to this now, you can go to any of our platforms and find the schedule and find out exactly when that panel will be.
And to find you on YouTube, what do they search for?
Pride Book Fest.
Pride Book Fest. Yep. Pride Book Fest on Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram.
Okay. And we have a link tree. So linktree.com/Pride Book Fest. You can find links to everything there.
Okay. I'll post the link to Linktree in the show notes to make it easy for folks to find you. That'll be nice and easy. Are you writers yourselves?
I am a writer. My debut young adult novel, it's contemporary. It's not a thriller. It's not a mystery. It's just straight up contemporary. And that came out in March. I have another contemporary YA coming out next March. And I have a couple of other things in the works as well.
What's wrong? Why do I have you on here if you didn't write a mystery?
Because we're giving out good mystery content for Pride Book Fest.
Exactly. Now,
I'm thrilled at the number of young adult and kids books that are being written by queer writers. So thank you. We're seeing more and more, and I think it's really important.
Absolutely. Thank you.
What more can we expect other than just the mystery panel?
Oh, Jacob, what do we have? We have so many things going on.
As of recording this panel, we have panels about fantasy, which, you know, retellings and magical worlds. We have adventures, pirates, mermaids, space operas. We have a whole panel that's going to be dedicated to talking about the craft of writing queer characters.
Middle grade writers. We have a panel all about queer activism. What else? We have a coming of age panel, which talks about, you know, coming out and first loves and all of that in teen stories.
We have a panel about queer coding, the history of like monsters and villains and the idea of queer coding them and how authors are reclaiming that kind of those tropes.
We have a body positivity panel.
We'll have a panel about sex positivity in queer YA.
So many. A panel on bisexual identity in publishing and how publishing treats bisexuality. We have a panel all about own voices and online harassment that queer writers face.
Holy shit, that's a lot.
We're missing some.
You guys have been busy as hell. I'm concerned about the bisexual panel because, you know, bisexuals don't really exist.
I know, right? It's such a crazy. Yeah, that's a mystery right there.
Yeah, Wendy and I discussed that when she was on the show that there are still plenty of people that believe that.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of bisexual authors face a lot of online harassment. So that's something that we definitely wanted to have specific authors talk about because I feel like it doesn't really get talked about that much.
So again, give us the dates.
Friday, June 11th, Saturday, June 12th, and Sunday, June 13th. We're probably going to start around noon on Friday and go until probably 8 o'clock on Sunday. Eastern Standard Time, we're going to, you know, we're not going to upload anything in the middle of the night. But yeah, everything's going to be airing during the day on those three dates.
Okay. And again, I'll have the link tree in the show notes and you can look at the outrageously huge number of panels that are going to be at Pride Book Fest, as well as other things going on. And I personally want to thank you very much for doing this, especially thank you for having a mystery panel.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, and coming up, me and Justine. Justine, I got to tell you, Pride Book Fest coming up in a couple of days sounds really exciting, but I know I cut into some of your time here, so I'm not going to banter with you at all. I'm sorry. I'm going to be boring. I'm not even going to bring up Paul Rudd.
Yeah, I know. You send me Paul Rudd videos all week, so, you know, I don't need any more banter about Paul Rudd.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you jump right into it. What book are you going to talk about today?
I'm going to talk about the psychology of time travel. And I got to say, this is a phenomenal book. We all know how much I love time travel, but this is unique. Most of the time travel books start at the present and then they travel back to some past event. And then you've got, you know, the Yankee in King Arthur's court, you know, the person out of time. This is very different. This book, the four women invent time travel. And then over the next 50 years, time travel becomes very common. It becomes part of the fabric of life. I will say that I did some looking through the reviews on this because I wanted to make sure, since it was in the LGBT category, I wanted to make sure that it was actually had some lesbian characters. These were all women mostly, so lesbian characters. Because we all know that just because it's in the LGBTQ mystery doesn't mean it's LGBTQ material. Nor does it always mean it's a mystery. So sometimes you got to read through those reviews.
Yeah, there's some sneaky devils. Who wrote the book?
I knew you were going to ask that question. Mascarenhas. So the reviews say that it was pretty hard to follow. I did not find it hard to follow at all. Each chapter's got a date. It's got a character name. And, you know, they're short. They don't get overly twisted. It's very easy to follow in my view. So some of the rules about time travel are not as you usually would imagine them. You can actually meet yourself. You can run into yourself in the past and the future. So what happens in some of the scenes is that, say, a woman gets married, her future and past selves will often show up. So at one wedding, there are seven, what they call the older ones, the future selves are silver me, the past selves are green me. So at a wedding, there'll be seven silver me versions of the woman there. At one wedding, there were five versions of the woman, and she was a ballerina, and she performed all the parts of a ballet. In other places, there are only one version, and the one version gets there and realizes that she's disappointed that there aren't other versions of herself there. So that is the one of the rules that they break.
It sounds like things can get really messy if you change things in time.
Well, that's the other rule. You can't change things in time. But, and I'm not quite sure how to explain this. So you're all going to have to read the book. You can't change things in time, but you can learn from them. So just as you can't change the past and, you know, you learn from it, you can go back and think about it. You can talk to people about it. The same is true of the future. You learn from the future. Your future self will come back and tell you, or you'll go to the future and you'll see how things are, and you'll learn from that also. You can make decisions based on that. You find out who you're married to, and then you meet them, and you know, okay, this is the person I'm going to marry. Sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're not, but that's the person you're going to marry because it's in the future and you know it.
You can't back out.
Now, one of the more intriguing things is two of the women who end up married in the book do not come from the same time. So when they're actually together, they're the same age, but one is 40 years older in her chronological time. But the version that shows up is not as the same age as the woman that she's talking to. There are only a few people that time travel. A lot of people don't time travel. Apparently, if you have any sort of history of mental illness, the travel through time does weird things to your brain that your brain can't handle.
And I don't think I'd want to know what's going on.
Well, it's as if the future is part of the past. It's really living life in a different order. And I think if you read the book, you'd go, oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. That doesn't seem much different how it is now. It's a little more complicated, but it's not much different. And you can go back and see people that after they've died, you go back and you see them and they know you're back there from the future. So it's not like you got to like not change the timeline or anything. This one woman goes back and visits with her father pretty frequently and before he dies. And they get to know each other when she's an older person. So he died when she was a kid. And then she comes back from the future as an adult and they develop a whole new relationship that way.
It sounds fascinating. I'm interested to see how a mystery fits in this.
Well, what happens is that there is a murder pretty early in the book. And the murder takes place at a time certain. And then they don't know exactly who gets murdered. And they travel back and forth in time to put the pieces of this case together. Now, what's interesting is that criminal investigations, you can't share details. So if you're investigating a crime, you can't go back and tell your earlier self what the evidence is and who did it. So time travel and preventing a crime is you don't prevent it, but you go back and you have to collect the evidence yourself, but you can't go and tell your younger self of it. And they have their own, they have the Conclave, which is the Time Traveling Institute. They have their own set of laws and rules because legalities change throughout. So if you're committing a crime in 2027 and you're being tried back in 2000, well, you know, the laws are all going to be different all over. So the Time Travel Institute and the time travel people all have their own sets of crimes and they police time travelers.
I know you don't like things too convoluted. It sounds like this could be, and I presume since you liked it, it's not.
It's convoluted, but she explains it very well. She walks you through it. And They have one toy that they invented from time travel where it's called a candy box. And a kid puts something in a piece of candy in the candy box. It disappears and then it reappears a minute later. So it's basically a toy, fun thing. And that ends up figuring into a lot of the plot as you go along. It starts out as a kid's toy, and then it becomes a clue in the murder.
Interesting.
So I liked it. I got to say, it's a fun recommendation for me. I had a great deal of fun with this.
This is the second fun recommendation we've had.
Okay.
I think. Because that's one of the new ones you created.
It is one of the new ones. It's also delightful. It's a delightful recommendation, too. The fun book did not really strike me as delightful, but this is a delightful book.
This is fun and delightful.
Yeah. The author is a professor, I think, of psychology and feminist studies. So she explores a lot of, big topics, but, plays with them within the fiction.
Well, her background makes it sound like it would be really cool.
It is really cool. I keep telling you it's really cool. What do you mean it makes it sound like it's really cool? It is cool. I recommend everybody read it, and it's really amazing.
I'm saying on top of everything else, you just made it sound even cooler. So we have a fun, delightful recommendation.
Yes. Yeah. It's terrific.
And before I let you go, when you said that you can actually go back in time and see yourself, I got to tell you something that came to my mind, and I'm going to apologize in advance because I know your daughter is a kindergarten teacher, so we usually try to keep your opening segment clean.
Oh, God, no.
What immediately came to mind was if somebody said, go fuck yourself, you could say, okay.
Yeah, they addressed that too.
No, I have to read this.
That's right.
All right. I never expected that to be real, but anyway, it sounds good.
It's a great book. It's I think in a month or two, I'm actually going to reread it again. Knowing the end, I think I'll appreciate the ride a little more even. This is one of my favorite books ever.
Well, I have coming up Mia Manansala, and she was a lot of fun to talk with, so hope you enjoy.
All right. See you later, Brad.
Hi, this is Brad. Not only do I interview authors, I write novels too. Check out my Mitchell Riley mystery series on my website, bradshreve.com. My guest today, Mia P. Manansala, and she'll correct me if I said that wrong, is a writer and certified book coach from Chicago who loves books, baking, and badass women. She uses humor and murder to explore aspects of the Filipino diaspora, queerness, and her millennial love for pop culture. Her debut novel, Arsenic and Adobo, came out May 4th, 2021, with Berkeley Penguin Random House. A lover of all things geeky, Mia spends her days procrastinating, playing JRPGs, and dating Sims, reading cozy mysteries and diverse romance, and cuddling her dogs. I'll hope I get this one right, too. Gamijo, Max Power, and Bailey Banks. Rest in peace. And you get bonus points if you get all the references. Welcome, Mia.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brad.
It's a pleasure to have you. I briefly kind of sort of met you when we did Queer Noir at the Bar together, which these are usually done in coffee houses across the country, but we did it on YouTube. And not only was I impressed with your reading, as soon as it was done, a friend of mine who listened in to hear how I did, he didn't talk about how I did. He raved about your reading. He was like, all I could think while she was reading was, wow.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Now, Arsenic and Adobo is the first of the Tito Rossi's kitchen mysteries. Mm-hmm. And I want to happy to say that it's good to hear that it was the first, because that means more are coming. And I can't wait to hear more. Your debut novel is with Berkeley Random House. You've had rave reviews, much talk in literary circles. And oh my God, I looked at your Goodreads and you have almost 10,000 reviews. Every author I know would kill to have over 9,000 reviews. How does all that attention feel?
I mean, like, honestly, even good things can be overwhelming, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so even though I love that my book is getting a lot of attention, I have to kind of pretend that Goodreads doesn't exist. So, you know, I fully believe that everyone has their own opinion. No book is for everyone. No piece of media or art in general is for everyone. And that's fine. But I also don't need to subject myself to that. I also think it's better when there's like a nice divide between like the author and the reader. I feel like readers should feel comfortable and safe having their own opinions and being able to debate and things like, you know, unless they're like, you know, racist, homophobic, you know, unless they're like prejudice and hate filled reviews, which unfortunately I do have a couple. But like, if you don't like it, you should feel comfortable talking about this book that you don't like without having to worry about my feelings and where I don't have to worry about, you know, these negative things as well. So I think when it's healthy for both the reader and the reviewer to have that divide. But I am, you know, again, the attention, always really great. You know, it's better than having like 2 reviews and no one knowing that my book exists. So, you know, it's like good problems to have, of course.
That is a good problem. So it sounds like you actually read your reviews.
In the beginning, just because it was one of those, because it was like early reader reviews. So when it was still an ARC and I didn't have a physical book because I only had electronic ARCs. And this is my debut. So in many ways, it still didn't feel real, right? I had that cover. You know, I knew it was all going to happen, but it still didn't feel real to me. So when I saw reviews coming in from people who didn't actually know me, I was like, oh my God, like this is not just someone who is a friend of mine and kindly read my book to help support me. This is a random stranger who just requested an early copy of my book because I thought it sounded good. So I wanted, you know, to see what happened. And again, even then, the early reviews were pretty good. But that's when I realized, oh, some of them were being very, very personal in the things that they were sharing about what the book meant to them. And I'm like, you know, maybe it's not necessarily meant for my eyes and things like that. I mean, personal on their part, not against me. So I want to make that clear. And I'm just like, you know, if they're going to be that open and vulnerable, maybe I should give them the space, you know, for them to feel comfortable doing that. So I stopped reading fairly early on, especially once the book of the month pick happened and like my reviews exploded. I was like, oh yeah, definitely not. My mental health cannot handle all of this.
I will say, yeah, it's nice when friends and family read your book. They almost always say, it's wonderful. My sister, I remember saying, I would actually buy this book. And I thought that felt good. But it is a lot different when people you don't know are saying good things about your book. It really makes a difference because, you know, people, your friends and family are going to say something nice. Based on my limited experience, I used to read my reviews. And as you probably know, you'll get 50 great reviews and then one that isn't so hot and you focus on the one.
Yes.
So then those that came before me suggested stop reading your reviews. Given that you have, is there anything that you've read that you've learned from?
You mean like regarding the reviews?
Or regarding your writing or maybe future novels?
I mean, I guess for me, okay, so I do read everything that is sent to me through, like I have like a contact form on my website. So those always do get read. And
right.
And the vulnerability and the openness that people have been willing to share with me about what my book means to them has meant a lot. There's one in particular that I can think of with an Asian American writer, up and coming writer. She's not published yet. And she said that reading my book made her realize that it's possible for her to tell her own story in her, because before she read my book, the book she was writing, her protagonist was white and she's of an Asian American background. And then she read my story and realized, wait a minute, why am I writing these characters that don't reflect me and my experience just because I feel like, you know, because she's writing a thriller. So she's like, oh, you know, I'm not writing about Asian Americans. Why, you know? But then she read my book, which again has an Asian American protagonist in a murder mystery. So it's not about the identity. She just happens to be that. She's like, oh, I want that. I want to be able to see myself in a page on the page where my identity helps shape the character, but it's not the main point. It's not the only thing. I get to, you know, I get to be in the suspenseful story and put my own background into it and just have it be a regular mainstream novel. And so she was like, it seems like it should be obvious that I should be writing my own story. But I as in like the author, but she's like, but I didn't even think about making myself a protagonist until I saw what you did in your book. And I realized it was possible. And like, that meant so much to me. So I realized, you know, in my head, I always thought representation is important, you know, of anybody, you know, whether it's like, you know, queer characters, you know, characters of color, you know, and I've all, you know, all the varying kinds. I always knew how important that kind of representation was to me. But hearing people reach out and explaining exactly how that representation impacted them and their writing and their point of view and their way of thinking, like, it made me realize how important it is, like in a global sense, not just like personally for me, because I wrote this book for myself. I wrote Oscar Nkandoba because this is what I wanted to see. And now I realize by writing what I wanted to see, I can impact other people as well.
I love the awesome story about the woman that read about the diversity. That is great. In 2018, Sisters in Crime honored you with the Eleanor Taylor Bland Award, and that recognizes an emerging writer of color working in mystery. I'm not going to say congratulations. I always say you don't get a congratulations because you earned it, so I'll say great job. How has diversity – I mean, when it comes to being queer – we know Joseph Hanson in 1971, I think it was, wrote Fade Out. And as the years have gone on, queer mysteries have become much more accepted. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, how has other diversity, such as ethnicities, been viewed in the past?
It's because with publishing, they always look at it as trans. So I've talked about this before with my mentor, Kelly Garrett, who's Black. And so she was telling me that in the 90s, there was a huge boom in both like Black publishing, like of all kinds in all genres. And I've also heard from other people like that, there was also a big in like queer publications as well. Like there were like these big like lesbian imprints or like dedicated solely to gay. Like in the 90s, it was big business. And then slowly they started to fade out, almost as if it was a trend, and suddenly these, you know, no one was reading them anymore, which we know is not true, mm-hmm. but the money was no longer there pushing these stories. And so by the time I kind of joined, you know, the crime fiction community, it's not that they didn't exist. It's that I wasn't aware of them because I'm of a slightly younger generation. You know, in the 90s, I was, you know, still in elementary school. So when I was old enough to kind of like start picking out like my own books, these were not available to me because the marketing wasn't there. So many of them were out of print and it was so hard to find. Mm-hmm. And so seeing like the slow growth where, yes, it is changing, maybe not fast enough, but it's there, is very encouraging. And I just worry that publishing still sees this as like a diversity boom, like it's a trend, and that eventually it's like, oh, okay, we did our part and it's going to fade away again. And I really don't want to see that. But what I would love to see more of is the intersectionality of these various identities, right? Because I am a person of color and I am queer. And so a lot of times you'll see one or the other, but it's not always as apparent that, you know, you can be more than one thing. So like when I read like, you know, Cheryl Head's books, I was like, oh my God, this is great. I've recently become aware. I think Michael Nava has some great books. I'm so like, you know, my list keeps growing and growing, and that makes my heart feel so full as well. But again, it's this, if you don't know what to look for, if you are not actively searching out, oh, I want more crime writers of color, oh, I specifically want queer crime writers, it's harder to find in the mainstream. It's harder for like a casual reader to find us. And that's where I think the issue is.
It's great to hear that you wrote it for yourself. There are writers that write strictly to market. Mm-hmm. And I love hearing that you wrote what you wanted to write and still, for your first book, extremely successful. So do you see it getting better?
I mean, honestly, I hope so. Like, this is my first book getting published, but it's not the first book that I finished. It's not the first book that I had an agent with or tried to sell. My very first book that kind of introduced me to the crime fiction, the kindness of the crime fiction community, was titled like Death Comes to Comic-Con. And it starred a queer Filipino-American millennial character solving murder mysteries at a comic book convention. And this was back in maybe 2017, 2018 that I finished it, and I was shopping it around with my then agent. And at the time, all of my rejections, like I'll say like 70% of my rejections had the same general feedback, which is, we love the writing, we love the voice, we cannot sell this. There is no market for this. For a younger and queer and Filipino-American protagonist in a traditional mystery genre, which according to them, again, in my rejection letters, they said skewed to older, white, like middle-class women. They didn't see there being a lot of overlap between what I was writing and to who they traditionally marketed to. So, I mean, things, yes, are getting better, but within like, you know, this, that was what, 3 years ago, yeah. I was being told that it wasn't.
Oh, that breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I didn't go out of my way to write a more marketable second book. Like, again, like, I think writing is so hard and I'm still so new to this that if I'm not writing what I'm enjoying, I don't really see the point. You know, later on, maybe when I get a little bit more seasoned and I'm like, well, you know, it's my job. There's nothing wrong with writing to market because it is a job. Mm-hmm. But where I'm currently at in my career, I'm pursuing the things that I want just because at the moment I can.
Arsenic and Adobo. I love the title, by the way.
Thank you.
It's great. It's a cozy mystery. I don't think I've had very many cozies on this show. For listeners that aren't aware, I talk to people and they're like, what's a cozy? So our listeners that aren't aware, what is a cozy?
Sure. So I like to call them, you know, like Hallmark movies with dead bodies. Basically, it is like a traditional mystery with an amateur sleuth that doesn't have on the page graphic violence, sex, or bad language, shall we say. There are, you know, if you want to get like, there are probably other parameters, or shall I say like genre expectations, but those are the main three. If you hit those three, you're pretty good. Like they're meant to be lighter, a little bit more humorous, you know, again, like they're called cozy because they're supposed to give you that feeling when you read that, like almost like, you know, like, a nice light, you know, beach read, or, you know, curl up with a blanket and a cup of tea kind of thing. But those are the three mainstays, the watching for the sex, violence, and language.
Mentioned beachy, some of the reviews I saw said that yours is a good beach read. How does that make you feel? What do you think that means?
I know some people would almost use that as an insult, but I am perfectly happy to entertain. That's why I love genre so much. So I know that more literary fiction, no matter what genre is, it's very important. It is beautiful prose. You can get lost in those words, but that's not my style, and that is not currently what I'm going for. I believe that there's great importance in books that help you escape, that can make you laugh. Making people laugh is so important to me because I feel like, especially for the past year or so, you know, there haven't been a ton of reasons to laugh, so escapist media, shall we say, is hugely important to me. It's how, you know, in my bio it mentions diverse romance. I tell everyone, like, has saved my mental health the past year or so, just because the idea of women of color thriving and going after joy and love and knowing that they deserve it and are worth it has meant so much to me. And I want to give people that same feeling with my own writing, even though there happens to be dead bodies, which aren't usually the, you know, the feel good stories you think they are.
This is about you, not about me, but I've also been told quite often that my book is a good beach read. And what I like about that is during the Depression, the MGM big grand musicals were hugely popular then because people needed that. And they always need entertainment. Do you feel like you are trying to teach anything at the same time?
I believe like most anything, particularly with crime fiction, has to have a point of view to really go anywhere, right? So yes, it's light and humorous, but it would be a disservice, I guess I'd say, to me and to the readers and to the people who go through like the issues that I touch on in the book to not bring in larger issues surrounding these communities. So, you know, even though it's a cozy mystery, I have an author's note in the beginning with some content warnings. Mm-hmm. Just because when you look at my cover, when you read it, again, it's bright, it's colorful. I truly believe it's a beach read, but there are some issues that I touch on in there, which if you go in there looking only for laughs, and you are kind of suddenly confronted with these tougher issues, it affects your enjoyment of it. And it almost feels like a betrayal, right? Because sometimes it's not the book itself. It's where you currently are in your life when you're reading it. And so, you know, I touch on like the opioid crisis. It's not on the page, but there's hints at maybe like domestic violence with one of the characters and, you know, and other things like that. And you're just like, I came here to laugh at this book that has an adorable puppy on the cover. And suddenly there's these dark, like, well, you know, this is the real world, you know, like I can't, like there are dead bodies. And even though it's fictional, any jokes I make are not at the expense of the life lost necessarily. You know, it's the jokes are not about the tougher issues. It's the things surrounding it to help you deal with those tougher issues. So yeah, I would say I always include some point of view. Sometimes it's cultural, right? Like again, just because it's my character is Filipino, it's not about Filipino culture. I'm not here to teach you Filipino culture necessarily, but if you learn something about it along the way, that's awesome. And I'm glad that people find that interesting. Same thing about certain social issues that I care about. But you know, again, when it comes to fiction, just because something is in my book doesn't necessarily mean I condone it, you know? So again, that's another thing I have to be careful about because people tend to mix those boundaries sometimes. But yeah, I hope at least things that people can learn when they read my books.
There's so much that we can talk about in limited amount of time. So before we go any further, we need to talk about the novel itself. Mm-hmm. It's usually right off the front, I ask people to tell us about the protagonist. With this book, it's kind of hard to do because we not only have Lila, we have her mm-hmm. aunt and the calendar crew and Adina. So let's talk about her, but the others too.
Okay. So this book, in the very beginning, it was me playing with like typical rom-com tropes. Because like I feel like a lot of rom-coms and a lot of cozy mysteries, at least in their initial inception, there tends to be a lot of crossover, right? It's like, as I said before, like it's amateur sleuth. It's almost always a woman who is from a small town, leaves to a big city, and then has to come back for some reason. Sometimes it's a failed relationship, poor business decisions, family, something like that. And it is their job to kind of like pick up the pieces, refix those bridges they've burned, fall in love with the community, with Christmas, with all those kinds of things. And so that's what I was doing with my character of Lila. She is a big fish in a small pond because she grew up in a fictional Midwestern town just a couple hours outside of Chicago. She has a disastrous relationship, has to return home, and she also has to save her aunt's failing business. So the series itself is called Tita Rosie's Kitchen. Tita means aunt in Tagalog. And Tita Rosie's Kitchen is the restaurant around which this entire first novel kind of revolves around. So her family business is in danger because her ex-boyfriend is the town's vindictive food critic and has been trying to get that restaurant shut down for a while. The story starts because one day he's there at the restaurant and mid-meal, mid-review, passes out, dies, and it turns out that it's murder, and obviously she becomes the main suspect. But with cozies, and in particular with the Filipino like culture, community is really, really important. So even though she's kind of lost when she comes back home, she's not alone. So she lives and grew up with her aunt and her grandmother, both who have very strong personalities, but in very different ways. So Tita Rosie is a very kind, loving woman, very open, very generous, but resilient, right? Many people might look at her as a pushover, but she has a strength that is maybe not as apparent when you first see her. Lola Flor, Lola means grandmother in Tagalog, it, she takes no mess. She lets you know what she's thinking. And she is that voice in Lila's head pushing her to always do better, for better or worse. And you mentioned the calendar crew. That is her group of godmothers, plural. She has three different godmothers, and they're all the April, May, and June, which is why she calls them the calendar crew in her head. They are also just very typical aunties, opinionated, in your life, loving, but also infuriating. And because they are the gossip hounds in the town, they're the ones that she goes to when she needs, you know, some like information that's maybe not as readily known. And Adina is her best friend. She's very ride or die. She stayed behind in the town when Lila went off to college. And now that Lila's back and they're trying to fix their relationship, because they stayed friends the whole time, but there was definitely a divide and a shift happening as Lila pulled further and further away because she thought she was too good for this town. And so her spending the time with the investigation, with Lila, with her family, has been showing her what she's missed all this time.
Beyond that, it's always touchy in a mystery to talk about the story because you don't want to give away too much. Mm-hmm. But when Derek, the food critic, I believe it's Derek, correct?
Yes, Derek.
Okay, her ex-boyfriend from many years ago and the food critic, he dies in the restaurant. But beyond that, what is her motivation to solve this crime? Most people let the cops handle it.
There is a couple of things. One of them is that she doesn't trust the police for various reasons. Her family has a past, shall we say, with the Shady Palms Police Department. And her family has been the victims of some of maybe their more corrupt, or we'll say like low-key shady practices before, which I lightly touch on in this book. We don't get the full story, but it does come out in one of the later books, like what really happened. So that's part of it, just her general distrust of the police. And also part of it is that she actually is arrested and has to spend the night in jail because they find evidence that is pretty damning. And her aunt puts the restaurant and their home up for collateral, for bail, to try to bail her out of jail. So it's one of those, like, not only do I not trust the police to actually do the right thing and figure this out, if they don't, my family loses everything, right? Not only do I go to jail, my aunt, my grandmother, they're out their business, they're out their home. So I you know, the stakes are pretty high for her.
Yeah, I liked the addition of the possible loss of the restaurant. I liked that additional tension in it. It really added to the story. There's a lot of humor in this book. The calendar crew had me laugh quite a bit. And going back to the death of Derek, the food critic, I don't want to give too much away, but it caught me off guard because it was, you know, just all of a sudden he's just dead. And his death alone was funny itself. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to write humor?
It's strange in that when it comes to writing humor, the difficult part is knowing when to hold back. Because I'm sure, like for many people, humor is a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy for me, because I'm the kind of person who avoids conflict in real life. So writing conflict on the page is hugely difficult for me. So whenever anything is too tense or starts to feel too real to me, my first instinct is to drop in a joke. My first instinct is to lighten it up. And sometimes it's the way to go. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes you, as a human being, but also as a writer and a reader, need to be able to sit with a moment and really feel the complicated nuance of what's going on, right? You can't laugh it away. You have to deal with it. And learning that is something that I still struggle with, especially, you know, like right now I'm editing book two, which I didn't put enough. Like I kept pulling back too much, knowing it, like, so in book one, when I was editing, I had to pull a lot of stuff out So I was like, okay, you know, I'm gonna be a little bit more serious and you know, heckle. And then so book two, I'm like, oh, I don't know if it's because I wrote this in the middle of a pandemic, but this is just kind of dreary. Let me put some stuff back. So finding that balance right now is the hardest thing, because luckily a lot of the good reviews, you know, say like, oh, tonally it's perfect. And I'm like, thank you, that's great. I'm finding the balance of like, there are lives lost. This is a murder mystery. Don't forget that. But also like, oh man, this is really hard, and people need humor to get through tough things. So maybe lighten it up in some areas. That balancing act is still something I'm struggling with, like, to this day.
When you have those sections of the novel that you have to rip out and you think they're well written and you actually like that part of the story, and you have to take it out because it just, you know, sometimes it just doesn't fit. You just wrote it because it's good. That really hurts.
It does. I'm like, it made me laugh. And they're like, okay, it made you laugh. But is it right for the story? Is it right for the moment? I'm like, oh, no. And it's like, I know they're right, but I don't, you know, you're right. It hurts.
Yeah. Cozies, it's not uncommon to have a lot of food involved. And there is a hell of a lot of food in this novel. A lot. Despite I don't speak Tagalog, I know the universal come here wave gesture. I used to work in Las Vegas, and we worked for the same company, but they were a different division of the company where we had quite a few Filipino women. And the break room happened to be right across from my office. And when I would step in, I got this all the time. And I really learned to love adobo and lumpia. What was really interesting to me is, unlike me that would take a sandwich and something for lunch, it was a potluck. Each one brought their own thing. I mean, it was planned. Each one brought their own thing, and it was a great potluck. It was a lot of fun. What I was really caught by the novel is it reminded me almost a lot of the Latin culture. The closeness of the family, how important food is. Were you concerned about, well, I'm going to talk about my novel real quick. I wrote a Latino character in my first novel, and I knew this person, you know, or a conglomeration of several people that I knew. And some readers said they didn't like that I stereotyped. And then there were some individuals that said, this was my family. This was my family. You really wrote to me. Was there any concern at all about the possibility that people may think it's a stereotype that you were writing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be honest, and it's sad and I get it, but like a lot of times the toughest critics are the people within your own community. Right. And I'm not just being definitely like other marginalized writers I've known. They notice that whenever it's someone from their own community that's giving negative reviews, they're usually the harshest ones. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I can understand it. It doesn't make it less hurtful, because it's one of those like no group is a monolith, no matter what you are. Right. So like I wrote the people that I knew. I wrote the experiences that I have. And just because it's not your experience doesn't make it inauthentic, doesn't make it not real. And they're like, maybe you see it as a stereotype, but again, like these people exist. I can understand if every single character seemed to follow a particular thing, but I believe, you know, in my books, I show very different types of characters, different ways of being. And that, I don't know, like some of the things that, you know, it's, you know, someone said like, you know, it's not a stereotypes. It's not necessarily that they're not true. It's that they're only one side, right? So it's not right. That these characters aren't real. I think the issue is when you're not balancing it and making them more 3D and things like that. It's strange, but there are people out there who want you to write the novel they have in their head. They bring into a novel their own expectations, and when it doesn't meet them in some way, they get upset about it. And again, you know, I understand particularly what those, there's not a ton of mainstream Filipino American books with Filipino American protagonists, right? I can understand getting excited because you think you're finally going to see yourself on the page, and then you pick it up and it's nothing like your life and you're disappointed, right? But I think you have to understand that the problem is not you. The problem is not the author. The problem is the industry and the lack of wide representation that we have. If you were able to choose, you know, like a plethora of Filipino American books with a plethora of Filipino American experiences, having one disappointing novel is not that bad. It's well, I only get five and none of these five represent the way I, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I was talking to someone yesterday and no one's ever like, who picks up a book and they're like, this does not represent, you know, the white middle class suburban, you know, white women that I am. I'm never reading this again. You know, like they're like, oh, I'll just pick up another white middle class suburban mom book, you know, because there's like a million of them.
Yeah.
You know, same thing with, you know, with queer readers. So many times they have such a limited selection that they put certain expectations on it, which is unfair for them as readers and for whoever the writer is, because you don't get to objectively enjoy the book. And again, I think that's just more of an industry thing. And I also think, particularly for a lot of like diaspora writers, there's that question of, am I enough? Am I Filipino enough to tell this story? Am I queer enough to tell this story? Am I X, enough to tell whatever identity this is? And so there's also that going in, you know, because I was born and raised in Chicago. I can't speak Tagalog. I can only understand it. What I know of my culture is through my own family. So as writing this, you know, I was careful to get a lot of outside readers, beta readers, because, you know, there's a difference. Like, is this genuinely a Filipino cultural thing? Or is this a my family thing? And, you know, sometimes it was both. And sometimes, you know, just having that outside perspective let me see when characters were being too stereotypical or too flat, because I wasn't giving them the nuance or the lived-in feels that they needed to be real. So I don't know that there's really like an answer to that. It's just like, but yes, I feel that pressure. And yes, I think it's unfair. But yes, I understand where it comes from at the same time.
We've talked about quite a few characters, but I did leave one out.
Okay.
And that is the town of Shady Palms, which is very much a character in this book. And I love it. I love it right down to the tacky plastic palm trees. Shady Palms in Illinois is kind of ridiculous in itself. Mm-hmm. And I know this tacky little town because I grew up in the Midwest and in the South, but since moving out west, a lot of the desert towns are tacky little towns for whatever reason. You grew up in Chicago, and that's where you live, but is it based on any experience that you've had?
Yes and no. So I started very generally with my idea of it being kind of similar to a Chicago suburb that friends of mine live in called like Skokie. Like very generally when I was thinking of the demographic, right? Because one of the things I wanted to do is that, yes, this is a small town, but hey, brown people exist, which we don't necessarily get a lot of in a lot of cozies, particularly small town based ones. And so I was like, okay, what is a demographic that would make sense that I'm used to? And so I kind of started there. And, you know, I'm so, so pleased that you said the setting actually feels like a character, because in all honesty, descriptions are my nemesis. I hate writing them. I'm so terrible. Like draft after draft will contain things that just say bracket, insert description.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I spent so much time focusing on that is because an early beta reader, one of my critique partners, when she was reading it, she was just like, where is this taking place? You know, she's like, these characters are great. Your dialogue is excellent, but it feels like it's happening in a void. She's like, they're moving in an empty space. And she wasn't wrong. You know, like, again, she was completely, completely right. But I didn't know how to bring that to life necessarily. And, you know, and again, I grew up in this. So like my idea of what constitutes a small town is probably different from people who actually grew up in small towns. So like talking to people who grew up in small towns give me idea of like population, how things move. You know, like I talked to friends, they're like, Mia, my town was so small, there were no stoplights. You know what I mean? I was like, that blew my... So like getting these different perspectives and trying to meld them into their own thing. And then that same friend was just like, oh, you know, this, like you said, it's this far away from Chicago. It has X amount, you know, population that you're picturing. It sounds a lot like Ottawa, Illinois. You should check it out. And I was like, oh, okay, I can take a trip and write it off as research. Perfect. So actually, I went on like a writing retreat there with friends, and I was like, oh, okay, I see. You know, like, I feel like Midwestern small towns are not that different from like a Chicago suburbs, you know, mm-hmm. maybe population size, maybe certain things. But in general, I was able to kind of cobble these experiences together. But I also wanted it to feel like a little ridiculous just because like I wanted it to be its own world. So like Shady Palms kind of actually started off as like a placeholder name. I was like, I don't know, because I started with something really basic as the first. I think it was like Shady Oaks. I was trying to think Midwest, and I kept Googling and finding that these places actually existed. Like Shady Oaks, Illinois exists. Shady Grove, Illinois exists. Shady Pines, Illinois exists. I was like, damn it, you know, I don't want a real place. I wanted to create my own one. So I'm like, okay, I bet you there's not a Shady Palms. It'll be a placeholder name until I can think of something better. But then I was able to come up with a ridiculous backstory that had the name make sense. And I was like, this is exactly what I need to give my world the feel that it deserves. So I'm kind of happy I stuck with it.
Well, I know some experienced writers that in just a few words can give you a description of a person or can give you a description of a town. I mean, just a few sentences. That's a real struggle for me, but you did a good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, it worked. Well, now is the time on the show where we have what's called awkward questions authors get. And what I do is I surveyed dozens of authors and said, tell me some questions that you get that are uncomfortable or some that you've had that are just downright weird. And so I have those collected, and what I do is I spin the wheel, and you get one.
All right.
All right, so hold on, and let's see here. Okay, I've got your question. Are you ready?
Yeah, I guess so.
Are you ever going to write a real book or just stick with mystery?
Yes. Which is so funny because I originally wanted to, I kind of stumbled into mystery, even though it's kind of always been one of my favorite genres ever since I was a kid. I always thought I would write kid lit or fantasy. And like all my kid lit writer friends who, you know, the middle grade and the YA, they get that all the time. Even the ones who are like New York Times bestselling are like, oh, well, that's cute. But like you write for children, you know? You know, try something more challenging, something more adult. And I'm just like, and it's always by, it's almost always by people who don't write themselves and don't get how hard it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have gotten not so overt as that, but yes, like when are you going to start writing more serious? Because again, like, as I said before, usually when you're a marginalized author, particularly a person of color, people expect poetry or literary fiction from you. They expect you selling your trauma. They expect you writing the struggle book. And when you're just like, no, I wrote, you know, a murder mystery set at like a Filipino restaurant. They're like, oh, that's cute, I guess. But like, don't you have more to say? You know, kind of a thing. If I had something to say, I would say it. And I would say it, you know, there are so many different ways to deliver that message, as I mentioned earlier. And I'm very happy being a genre writer. And I don't think there's anything less real. There's nothing, you know, that the craft is still there. The heart is still there. The struggle is still there. These books will always be real to me.
Okay, well, my guest today was Mia P. Manansala, and her debut novel is Arsenic and Adobo, which is hot off the press, and it is going off the shelves very well, and a lot of good feedback. As usual, there will be a link to purchase the novel in the show notes, as well as how to reach out to Mia. Thank you very much for being on the show.
And thanks for having me, Brad. These were some really good questions.
It's been a pleasure. Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.